I think Thuan is giving me the indication that he has Dr. Tim Keller on the phone. Tim, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Wonderful. We're glad to have you here via telephone at the Twin Lakes Fellowship, live from New York, no doubt. Are you in New York today?
Yes, I sure am.
Well, I don't need to introduce Tim Keller to this assembly of folks from not only the PCA, but from a variety of other denominations. Tim Keller is one of the real treasures of God's church and has pastored the Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan for a number of years. Recently, he has written this book, The Reason for God, which is subtitled Belief in an Age of Skepticism. And he has very kindly agreed to come and speak with us via telephone today about this book. The book has received a tremendous response. As many of you know, it has climbed high into the top 10 of the New York Times bestseller list. And one of our friends who's here today, in fact, who gave an address yesterday, a powerful message to us, has said this about this book. He said, as a Westminster grad, I had to smile in recognition of the apologetic methodology of this book. Moving on to the unbeliever's turf in order to show the inconsistencies of their own worldview, and then demonstrating that only a Christian worldview can make sense of anything. It was just like Van Til, only without the confusing terminology and a whole heap more readable and winsome and literate and interesting and, well, better. That was our friend Sean Lucas, the Senior Vice President for Academic Administration at Covenant Seminary, commenting on his blog on the reason for God. So, Tim, thanks so much for being with us today. Tell us, how did you come to write this book? Why did you want to write it? How did it start in your mind?
Well, the historic origins of it were a young woman in the church who had graduated from Yale, had become a Christian at Yale, and now moved to the city and was working here. And she was Jewish, and she had two parents who were both psychiatrists, Jewish psychiatrists, and they were absolutely appalled by her conversion. Hmm. And they had come after her with all kinds of arguments, and it sort of overwhelmed her. And her experience of Christ was pretty experiential. Actually, I think she'd become a Christian through a charismatic church, I believe, originally. When she came to Redeemer, I was doing a series for our small group leaders, of which she was one, on apologetics. And it was enormously helpful to her. And she said, please put this into a book version, and don't just address it to Christians and small group leaders, but to non-Christians. And then I could give it to my parents, and a lot of other people could use it too. That was actually 6 or 7 years ago now. And we started by, she did an email correspondence with her non-Christian friends who also had graduated from Yale, and asked them for what was the thing about Christianity that was the most difficult to swallow. And we did a distillation and analysis of all the emails, and we tried to narrow down their biggest problems with Christianity, and then I cross-referenced that with my experience here in Manhattan, and came up with a basic outline of the book that way. And a young woman actually has since moved away. She was a literary agent at one point. I thought I might actually be working with her, but she's gone now. But I very, very much appreciate her instigation. So that's how it started.
Now, Tim, you wanted this book to be addressed directly to skeptics, not primarily to Christians gathering to answer skeptics, but addressing them directly. Tell us a little bit about your purposes there. How did you want the book to be placed in terms of its position to speak to a particular audience?
Well, I addressed it. It's addressed to a skeptic. And I thought that was different, because most of the apologetics books are actually written to Christians, giving them ammunition. And so the average, in fact, even the books that seem like they are written for non-Christians, if you read them a little more carefully, like the two Lee Strobel books, are really written to Christians to give them ammunition. So I wanted actually to imagine myself in a dialogue with a non-Christian and actually speaking to a non-Christian. And so that's how I pitched the voice of the book. I thought that this would actually help Christians who read it, because it would give them not just content for apologetics, but also an actual case study of it. And then, of course, I needed to go to a place where I thought it would come out into mainstream bookstores, and that's why I went to Penguin, not to a Christian bookseller, so that it's not out there in just Christian bookstores, and it's also not even back in the religion department, but it's out front in Borders and Barnes and Nobles and things like that.
Tim, talk to us a little bit about the tone of the book, because in the last few years we've seen a number of pretty virulent atheist screeds against Christianity and religion, and then we've seen some equally virulent rejoinders to those atheist screeds. This has a very different tone, and yet you're addressing some of the very arguments that have been marshaled by the Sam Harris's or the Christopher Hitchens of the world. Talk to us a little bit about the tone that you wanted to strike in your response.
Well, I wanted the tone to be different from the atheist books as well as the content. You see, I think what's different about the new atheist books is they're not simply saying that religion is bad. That's been said before. What's new about these books is they're saying that even respect for religion is bad, and respect for religious believers is bad, that you must disdain and mock and ridicule, and that there's no place for religious thought at all. And I thought that by not only countering the content, but countering the spirit, I thought there's a pretty high percentage of skeptics out there who would see that a gracious response would be winsome. I do think there are some skeptics that are unnerved by it, and I've talked to a number of them. They're very frightened by the gracious tone, because they sense that it makes it more attractive, and they're very frightened by it. And Ligon, one person has said, "I don't like you putting a smiley face on conservative theology." and what they meant by that, I could see in a way that might be. I don't want to put a smiley face on conservative theology either. I don't want to be namby-pamby. But I do want to show gospel humility. And I think if you show gospel humility to a self-righteous atheist, that it definitely scores points in the minds of the more neutral or more objective observer.
And you can even see that in some of the reactions to the book by secular reviewers that have come out. I think that has come through loud and clear, and that's only helpful in terms of commending the gospel. Talk to us a little bit about your apologetic approach here, Tim. We've already given the tip of the hat in my introduction to Van Til through the words of Sean Lucas, but you also deploy evidence in your argumentation. Talk to us a little bit about your approach here.
Right. I thought a lot about my approach. I'm not a complete pragmatist, and contrary to maybe what some people would think of you. I mean, when it comes to apologetics, I certainly want to be effective, but I do believe, like a good Van Tilian, that you should not cede the high ground to a skeptic who sits there in the chair of rationalism and says, "I have reason. Now you come to me, and make proper obeisance to the high chair of reason, I may believe in God." And I think what Van Til would say is you have to humble the skeptic and show them that without God, reason doesn't work, or there is no such thing as reason. Or I think you have to humble the pride of the rationalist, and I do that early on. And a number of ways I try to show people that. You can't sit there and say that. But once you have humbled their reason and you show that without God, reason doesn't work, cognitive faculties, can't be trusted and so forth, then I do think, like Tom Notaro, a friend of mine from many years ago who wrote a little book called Van Til and the Use of Evidence, and I don't even know if it's in print anymore, but it's a little Presbyterian Reformed publication book that shows that within the statement, if you have actually humbled their reason and shown them that they mustn't insist that you prove God through rational proofs of God. Once you've humbled them, then you can come back with evidence and appeal to their reason as well. So I do stick a good old-fashioned chapter on the evidence for the resurrection in the book, but only after I have, I think, first worked on humbling the rationalist earlier in the book.
Tim, you mentioned the email to the Yale graduates that garnered for you some of the key intellectual and other types of objections to Christianity that you have focused in on, these sort of seven defeater beliefs. Walk us through the chapters. I'll just read the chapter headings of chapter 1 through 7. There can't be just one true religion. How could a good God allow suffering? Christianity is a straitjacket. The church is responsible for so much injustice. How can a loving God send people to hell? Science has disproved Christianity, and you can't take the Bible literally. Presumably, these were the most frequent or the most compelling objections that you were seeing in common in the responses from the folks at Yale and other people that you've been interacting with in New York?
Yeah, yes.
And so you focused in on these, and you wanted to provide a compelling rejoinder to these defeaters before you then went on to present your positive case. Is that how the book is laid out?
Yeah, because I think the first half is to show people that there's no compelling reason not to believe, and that all the supposed a-theological arguments, all the arguments that propose to say Christianity can't be true or there can't be a God, they fail. They make good points, but they fail. They don't. They're perfectly surmountable. There's no good reason not to believe. The second half are, well, why believe? And that's where I would, talk about what Christianity actually teaches and how it makes more sense of our lives. So the first half is more negative. You might say it's actually what you call negative apologetics, dealing with objections, and the second half is positive apologetics, presenting the gospel.
Tim, you have been on a pretty aggressive speaking tour since the publication of this book. You've been on a lot of secular college campuses. You've been at Stanford and Berkeley and lots of other places. And of course, a lot of that material is out actually available on the internet through YouTube and other sources. But are there things that you've learned in the course of those public addresses and Q&A sessions and interactions that you've had on these college campuses? Are there things that you've learned that you think would be helpful for us to learn in terms of our public facing of the culture with the gospel?
Well, I do. I would say this. I came back very convinced, and of course this will certainly make everyone at Twin Lakes conference feel affirmed. I felt that ordinary preaching, Sunday preaching, and talking to skeptics nearby in a process, people who live in the same town with you, people you can get to know and meet with them over a period of time, I felt that was way superior to flying in, having 1,500 people show up, hearing the big lecture, having a Q&A. In a way, that was great. And everybody on all these campuses was very happy. And I even got to share the gospel at Google, the big campus at Mountaintop, California. And it was an honor to go to Harvard Business School and to go to Harvard. And it was an honor to go and preach the gospel. I felt privileged. So I would never say it was a waste, and I know that had a big impact. But I actually felt in so many cases when talking to non-Christian skeptics that you need a process. You need time to ask them questions and also show them love, and it would be much better just to do this through the ordinary work of a church than through big events.
When you and I were corresponding about this, you mentioned that very thing, that you've come to be convinced as you have been preaching the gospel and working for not only the cultivation of a gospel community, but for personal conversions in the context of Manhattan, you've seen a need for non-believers to incubate under the preaching of the word in the local church for a period of time before they come to an embrace of Christ by faith. You want to talk about that a little bit in relation to this tour and what you're doing in the book?
Well, one is that if you, I believe, of course, I'm a kind of a Ed Clowney, Brian Chappell, Christ-centered preaching kind of guy, you know. And I think that when you find a way, no matter what the text, the theme of the text finds its climax in Christ. So if you're preaching Christ every week, you're actually preaching the gospel every week. And the gospel, in a new perspective, there's almost an infinite number of ways of preaching the gospel, in a sense. I mean, when Christ is the climax of a theme that has to do with the law, or has to do with sacrifice, or has to do with, if a non-Christian is sitting there and essentially hearing the gospel in multiple perspectives every week, I feel like the more secular person needs that now. I think that they need to saturate and hear it multiple times and in multiple perspectives before the pennies really drop. However, I think I said to you, Lig, that it might not be the same in the South. And I did, you know, I had a church in a pretty conservative place in the South for a number of years, so I can tell that at least in my part of the world now, it's very hard to get a lot of people even into the church to be under the preaching of the word. And so I do think that there need to be venues where people are just simply discussing these issues, and they hear Christians speak intelligently about the gospel, and that breaks stereotypes, and it might pique interest so that they can come to church. So I do think that there have to be pre-incubators that we're trying to work on developing here, and then the service itself is an incubator. The preaching of the word is an incubator for non-believers.
Tim, I think that's very important, and we've got a number of guys here from the Northeast and from the Pacific Northwest who I think are recognized. I saw a lot of heads nodding as you were saying that. Talk to us a little bit about those places that you're trying to create for that pre-incubator process where you can, where people can have a touch point with the witness of your congregation and engage in a place where they're safe about the important questions of life and even begin to touch on the gospel. Talk to us a little bit about what you're trying to put together at through the Ministry of Redeemer in regard to that pre-incubator process.
Well, the two things we have thought of are this. One is that we have small group fellowships, and we think the easiest way to create one of these venues would be to say take four small groups roughly in the same geographic area, and that usually represents say 40 Christians meeting. You know, ordinarily the groups are about 10 each on the average. And if you say to those 40 people, this winter, we are going to rent a room, a back room at a restaurant, once a month. And we're going to have a meal there, and we're going to try to bring non-Christian friends. We want no more than 20, and we don't want you to come unless you have a non-Christian friend. And we'll send out an evite to everybody, you know. And the evite will say, here's the subject, and someone's going to give a 12-minute talk on a subject, and it might be, does religion lead to holy war, or you know, how can you believe in God, or something like that. Bring your non-Christian friends, and we're going to talk. And so what you have is you have 40 Christians who are praying about the fact that four or five times this year there's going to be a place where you could bring a non-Christian friend. So they're praying about bringing a non-Christian friend. Hmm. And generally, we've done some pilot programs here. We found that in general we have been able to get about 20, 25 people to these things, because you have a potential of 40 Christians and a potential of, you know, 80. You could, technically, if everybody came and brought a non-Christian friend, you could have 80, but it generally comes out to about 20, 25, and usually about half of them are non-Christians. And we have 45 minutes of discussion, and we have about 10 or 15 minutes of a talk. And it has gone very well. And at the end of, say, five or six of these, you'll find that some people keep coming back. And at the end of the 5 or 6 months, the ones who are interested, you invite them to something at the church, which we actually haven't created yet. And there's probably maybe a day at your conference center, or maybe a day somewhere else. It would be a short retreat in which you get a chance to look at the gospel more carefully. But our experience is that the non-Christians who come to those things and enjoy them find their way into the groups or into the worship service. So we're not sure what we call that. It's not the same thing as Alpha, as you can tell, or Christianity Explored, which is much more structured, where you come and you come for 10 weeks or 12 weeks, and you study the Bible. And, you know, we do not find that we can get a non-Christian to come to something for 10 or 12 weeks, you know, 10 or 12 Tuesday nights in a row. It just doesn't work.
That's very helpful. Tim, a lot of folks have asked in the book if you are defending mere Christianity or Reformed Protestant Christianity or something in between. Can you talk to us about how you're addressing that question?
Yeah, in the middle of the book, there's a section called Intermission. And there I do my very best, as winsomely as possible, as to say there is no such thing as mere Christianity. What I say there is that if you look at the Apostles' Creed, that there's a triune God who's created the universe, that we have all fallen and we're all sinful, and that Jesus Christ has come back in to accomplish our salvation for us, so we're saved by grace, and that when we believe in him, we're brought into the fellowship of the church, and someday he's going to come back to, you know, raise the living and the dead and create a new universe. And at one point I say, all Christians believe all that, but no Christians believe just that. Because as soon as you say, how do I get the grace of God? How do I believe? How do I come into the church? That immediately makes you Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, or it makes you Arminian, Calvinist. So there's no way to answer the actual questions of how you actually connect to God without immediately becoming, without giving an answer that is Protestant or Catholic. So what I try to say is, on the one hand, 80% of the chapters in the book, 13 out of the 17, are things that all Christians can affirm because they were just, I was actually arguing for the existence of God, the resurrection of Jesus, the deity of Christ, that sort of thing. However, 4 of the chapters on sin, religion and the gospel, and the cross, I say, I'm going to be talking as a Presbyterian minister because I have to. As soon as you get into some of these subjects, there's no way to be a generic Christian. So I tried to say on the one hand that frankly, and I have some Catholic friends, frankly, most of the book a Catholic can be very, very happy with, which sounds damning for a Presbyterian minister to say. But the fact is, most of the book is actually arguing for the existence of God and the truth of deity of Christ, etc. But that ultimately, of course, I'm defending. I don't use the words because I'm trying to be very gracious and generic to non-Christians, but I'm definitely a Reformed evangelical kind of Christianity. And most people who know read the book and they can smell it. People who don't like Reformed evangelical Christianity have smelled it and they don't like it.
Tim, in the Newsweek interview that was done with you recently, the author of that interview, in what giving you what I think she was trying to give you as a compliment,
yes,
has raised a lot of questions out on the blogosphere. She attributed to you belief in evolution.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you were trying to explain to her in that interview and what she obviously didn't pick up and yet passed on to the rest of America?
Sure. Well, you have a pretty educated audience there. I went to Gordon Conwell. I took 6 classes with Meredith Klein. You know, you might call me a Klein head, I suppose. And so I have the kind of classic framework hypothesis understanding that that Genesis 1 is a psalm, basically, about creation, and that Genesis 2 is a historical narrative. And what that means is that I'm not a young earth creationist, and I'm not sure to what degree God used any kind of natural selection, but it could be. There could be long periods of time in there. Also, I'm also very similar to Jim Boyce. I don't know if any of you have ever, if you've got his exposition of Genesis. In the very beginning of his exposition of Genesis, he lays out all the different approaches, and he calls one progressive creationism. And when I was coming out of seminary, I read that, and I said, that's me. So I basically saw myself as being a person who's a little bit agnostic about how God does it. I'm not a young earth creationist. I would believe that God might have used natural selection partially. I certainly believe in a historic Adam and Eve. So I have that approach. You know, when I came out of Gordon Conwell, an awful lot of folks in the PCA had that same view. I don't know how many do anymore. However, when I try to explain something like that to a secular, a very positive, very, you're right, Lisa Miller was very positive toward me. When I try to explain that to a secular Jewish New York journalist, she says, oh, then you believe in evolution. I mean, that's what she said. And, of course, for her, it's young earth creationism or you believe in evolution. There's nothing in the middle. So as soon as I started making any kind of qualifications, then she started to say, oh, you believe in evolution. So there we go.
Which is, I think, is her way of saying this guy is not a nut. You know, he's normal, he's intelligent, et cetera.
She was actually trying to say he's nuanced.
Yeah.
You know, and she's come away. There's several journalists I've spoken to, Sally Quinn at Washington Post, Lisa Miller at Newsweek. They're I think, recovering atheists. That is to say, they're becoming more respectful of Christians, at least some Christians, but that's as far as they've gone. Hmm.
Tim, you have said that the preaching of Dr. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, especially his expository preaching with an evangelistic edge, the preaching especially that he did on Sunday evenings,
right,
has had a profound effect on you. I think you've probably listened to as much Lloyd-Jones as any person in the English-speaking world. Can you tell us what you've learned from Lloyd-Jones that you think we need to learn and recover in our own preaching of the gospel?
Yes. Well, as you, like you would know, when you get a Lloyd-Jones tape, he almost always started every sermon by saying, I should like to call your attention this morning, or he'd say, I should like to call your attention this evening. Right?
Yeah.
He always started, and he would say, to the words of 1 Corinthians 8, or, you know, as he was reading the scripture, he'd always say, I should like to call your attention. And if he said this evening, it was an evangelistic sermon, because his understanding was his Sunday evening sermons were evangelistic, and his Sunday morning service sermons were edification for the saints. And when I started hearing his evening sermons, it electrified me, because I felt like that even though that was 1950s London, it fit perfectly for 1980s, 1990s New York. And I felt that with a little bit of perhaps edificational beefing up, I thought I could come up with an approach to expository preaching that would both evangelize and edify at the same time. And what was intriguing about the doctor was, if you listened to it, he was more likely to read from the newspapers. He was more likely to cite what the prime minister has just said. He was more likely to even use humor, which is pretty rare for him, but he did it. He definitely was appealing to a broader crowd, and yet he was thoroughly expository. He was not just giving you an ABC gospel presentation every week. I don't know that I'm doing a very good job of explaining it. If you know, the Banner has out a bunch of old, what they call Old Testament evangelistic sermons. I think there's still a Banner of Truth. Those are evening messages. But most of the things that you have read, if you've read them in print of the doctor, are not those evening messages. Very few of those have made it into print. And I would say it had a profound effect on me. I don't think I better go on any longer, because I'm not sure I've got a good way of distilling what the three or four qualifications are, but they really were very important to me.
That's a good word for us, because you can, through the Lloyd-Jones Trust now, it's easy to get internet access to those sermons. You can download them, put them on your iPod,
yep,
get up on your treadmill, and listen to him preach those evening services, mm-hmm, and glean ideas from them for having a more evangelistic edge to our expository preaching. Well, Tim, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Thank you so much for your ministry to the church. and for this book, which will help us in sharing the gospel with others.
Thank you, Lig, very much.
And we trust you have a great day and look forward to seeing you very soon.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.